call to order the regular and supplemental meetings. We want to start off with a moment of silence, but I also just want to specifically express, you know, sympathies to this young officer, Jacob Arellano, who passed away the other night, 25 years old, you know, relatively new in the force. Just tragic. He has a child, and his brother's also a Dallas police officer, from what I read this morning. So we want to specifically think of him, as well as everyone, with this moment of silence. Thank you. The next thing we want to go to is the consent agenda. And the approval of the minutes. Does anyone have any thing to say or discuss about the minutes? If not, can we get a motion to approve?
Move approval.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any
aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. The consent agenda. Kelly, anything there you'd want to flag?
You might have noticed that in this month's agenda there are a lot of retirements. I think there's 20 retirements and 19 refunds. So they're down 39 police and fire. Two-thirds of those are police, about a third are fire. They had a class this week of 55, police did. So they're trying to keep up, but they're, you know, leaving as fast as they're able to hire. October is a typically busy month for retirements because when they got the COLA in the past, people would join drop right before October, so a lot of people are hitting their 10 years in drop, but it is up. So if you're thinking retirements are going to stay that way, I don't anticipate they'll stay at 20 a month, but probably more like 13 to 15.
Got it. So can we have a motion to approve the consent agenda? Second?
Second.
All in favor? Say aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Public comment? Anyone like from the public would like to speak in person or online? John, anyone?
Oh, press 5-star.
Okay. So now we're going to go to fiduciary insurance review.
I will start with a little introduction. So first I would like to introduce our guests. So we have Mike Stoner with us, and Mike is with Haynes & Boone. We've asked Mike to take a look at our fiduciary insurance and really just talk to the board in general about what is fiduciary insurance, what does it cover, what does it not cover. So that's Mike's role, and he's got a PowerPoint presentation here. We also have with us a face that some of you may remember from the past, but maybe a voice from last year, James Martinez. He's with Gallagher. Gallagher's our broker. And is Eva on the phone as well?
Yes.
Yes, I'm here, Kelly.
How about Eva Gideon from Gallagher is probably also on the phone. And, James and
yes, Eva. I'm here.
Okay, thank you for jumping on the phone. We appreciate it. So they're here to answer any specific questions about our policy, premiums, coverage, issues in the market, those types of things. So the fiduciary insurance, as some of you recall that have been on the board for a while, this is our largest expense in the budget, other than salaries and benefits for employees. It's the largest expense. It's about 9% of the total expenditures for excluding investment-related expenditures, and it's growing very fast. So year after year, we've talked to the board about what is the proper level of coverage for this line of insurance. And, you know, frankly, when we've talked about it before, I think we've really focused on the plan aspect and not so much on your aspect as trustees. I mean, you're serving as volunteers on this board, and you have a right to be concerned about is there any liability that you're taking on for your role here. So hopefully when Mike talks about the what fiduciary coverage covers and doesn't cover, you can consider it both from a plan perspective and your perspective as an individual trustee. And I think Josh has some comments on that as well. But before I turn it over to Josh for a few comments on that piece, I wanted to show you a chart that we received from Gallagher, which is the next slide. John, can you go to that? And this is a chart we've provided you before. James was nice enough to update it, but this just gives you a comparison of different defined benefit plans that Gallagher has and the level of coverage that they have. So the top line here is our plan. We have $2 billion in assets. It says 5,000 plan participants, but that's wrong. We have 10,000 plan participants. And we have $50 million coverage limit. The next part of the chart is all the Texas plans and the size of their plans, the number of participants, and the limits that they carry. You can see those. And then the bottom chart is all of the defined benefit plans that have plan assets in excess of $1 billion. So that's just for your comparison to see where we are relative to other DB plans out there. And you can see we're very high. We have $50 million in coverage, and that is very rare. Especially for a $2 billion plan. So with that, I turn it over to Josh. The point of this whole presentation, by the way, is later in today's agenda we'll talk about the budget. And the board will need to decide at what level do you want a budget for fiduciary insurance. Gallagher has estimated that that coverage may go up 10%. It's gone up. The primary layer has gone up 350% since 2014. The secondary levels, the excess layers above the primary level, we have four layers. That's gone up. It was consistent really until last year. Then they doubled last year. So that's really what we're looking at there. Josh, did you want?
I know maybe what you're planning to do, but really I think that from the perspective of a trustee, what do I look to in terms of this, then this, then this, then this, in terms of liability production for us filling our role? I think that's probably the perspective that the trustees have.
Yes, that's right, Nick. So the trustees have several layers of protection. The city has an indemnity provision in the city code that allows the city to indemnify and advance expenses for trustees on the board.
Discretionary?
I think it's discretionary in the sense of like if you meet the criteria of acting in within the course and scope type of thing.
If you meet that standard, is it?
I think it's still permissive. It's not mandatory that they have to do it, but that's only in the. I think it's only in the sense of. I don't want to say that. I guess let me reserve that and check that.
Yeah, so I think that would be helpful to know that is that subject to some city council vote? Is it discretion of city manager? Is it only as simple as us, being deemed as acting in good faith and,
right.
All that kind of stuff? I think
right.
That would be helpful.
The board has the ability to indemnify and advance expenses as well, and that would be permissive. That would not be a mandatory. That you just have the ability to do that at your discretion.
With only the wherewithal of the plan, not
right,
the, yeah.
Right. Up to the extent of the plan asset.
Okay. And if there were a specific either at us or a specific person, how would that work from sort of a conflict or opining on something that we have a connection to?
So I think if it was something that was over and above insurance or something like that, where we could not put it to the insurance company.
No, I mean, if for instance someone sued me in mm-hmm. my capacity, would I have to recuse myself from voting on that, or how would that work?
If it required separate indemnity from the separate and apart from the insurance.
Either or.
Well, if it's the insurance, I think we would simply tender the claim to the insurance company and say, cover it. If it was outside the insurance for whatever reason, because it's above the limits, or the insurance company for some reason you know, I mean, not just issued a reservation of rights letter, which is standard, but simply said we're just not covering it, period, end, then the board, then I think there would have to be a board meeting, and yes, the person who was involved would clearly have to recuse themselves from voting.
What if it were the entire board being sued?
I think at that point, the board can still authorize it. I think the board would, you know, I think you would, what I would advise is you get an opinion either from myself or from an outside lawyer basically saying that you know, there's nothing there that indicates there's bad faith or fraud or any of the normal exclusions that would prevent the indemnity. So you have that ability, and then the statute specifically allows the board to purchase insurance to cover claims. And there's no dollar limit that the insurance could be. So, it's, I mean, theoretically, you could insure up to the value of the assets. So, I mean, there's a lot of different aspects or places where trustees can go to get coverage. And I think from the board's perspective, it doesn't make sense not to protect its members as well as employees and things like that, because you don't, I mean, there's no reason why people should have personal exposure for doing their jobs, acting in the course and scope of their either employees as employee, you know, employment, or trustees as their duties as you know, trustees and discharging their fiduciary obligation. So the chart that we've got up here that James provided, I mean, the historic context is the limit. We've had that $50 million limit for a really long time. It predates me, and I can't honestly tell you why the limits were that high. I don't think there was really any – I don't know the history behind the limits. It was here when I got here. And, you know, now starting in 2014 when we had the litigation beginning with the Eddington litigation and it's been carried forward, that's obviously that – together with the insurance market has spawned the huge increase in the premiums, and you know, James can talk to that if you like, I'm sure, and Eva. But you know, the limits were never, I'm not sure they ever made sense, and I think in some ways, you know, what Kelly would tell you and what I would tell you is, you know, sort of what we've tried to do in other areas. The chart shows pretty clearly that we're kind of outside the norm type of thing. And, you know, in a lot of the places we've tried to get back into the norm, and so this is just another aspect of trying to get back into the norm. But this is just a historic thing that I think from the very beginning when the insurance was acquired, it was pretty – the premiums were – or the policy limits were pretty high. So that's just a little bit of it. You know, we didn't ever – we haven't raised them ever – since I've been here since 2009, and I think they've just always been at that high level for a long time. They just didn't cost nearly as much back then. The premiums were not as expensive probably in general, and there was no claims experience, so there was just the budget. In terms of the magnitude on the budget, it just wasn't that high. So that's just a little bit of background. With that, I'll kind of turn it over to Mike, and kind of he'll explain to you what the policy covers and doesn't cover type of thing.
Okay, thank you. So I'm Mike Stoner. I'm a counsel at Haynes & Boone. I'll just introduce myself briefly. I've been doing policyholder side coverage litigation for the last 12 years. Our insurance recovery group only represents policyholders. We don't represent any insurance companies. So this is all coming through the lens of somebody on the insured side, just to give you the perspective of where I'm coming from. I spoke with Josh, and he asked me to give a brief presentation on fiduciary liability insurance, specifically looking at your policies, what it covers, what it doesn't cover. And I'll add some gloss on things that I've seen, disputes that I've seen arise involving these kind of policies with carriers. The first slide is just a summary of the fiduciary liability insurance program that I've seen. Multiple layers of the policy. Multiple layers of policies. These are follow form policies, so the excess layers involve the same terms and conditions that are in the primary layer policy. So that's helpful. So the focus of the discussion is going to be on the primary layer insurance policy issued by Markel American Insurance Company. I will just note that in my experience, there are often logistical challenges that can go with going from one layer to the next layer. While all the terms and conditions and scope of coverage might be the same under the language of the policies, excess insurance companies don't always interpret those insurance policies in the same way as the primary layer carrier. And they're not fundamentally bound by the primary layer carrier's interpretation. So one example of something that I've seen happen is the primary carrier is doing a great job and ends up paying out losses that are questionable about whether they're covered on the policy, but they give the benefit of the doubt to the insured, they pay it out, and then the excess carrier comes in and says, well, hold on, you haven't fully exhausted your first layer because these payments don't qualify as loss under the policy, and therefore we're not going to accept them as eroding your underlying limits. That's a dispute that we've seen happen. It's just something I wanted to alert about going from layer to layer, but that's just the nature of having a program with multiple layers. So the fundamental features of a fiduciary liability insurance policies, for those of you who have experience with D&O policies, they're structured very similarly. Who's the insured, the plan, the trustees, the employees? There's an endorsement that extends coverage to the investment advisory committee, as well as moving forward, if there's ever another additional insured endorsement that you want to add on to the policy with your broker, that's a way to get coverage for that group. These are claims made and reported policies. That's a standard feature of these types of policies. What does that mean? That means coverage is afforded for when the claim is made, and we'll talk about what a claim is in a minute. But it also has to be reported during the policy period. So when the claim comes in, that starts the reporting clock, and you have to report the claim before the end of the policy period. If you don't report it within the end of the policy period, insurance companies are going to deny the claim.
Let me interrupt you here right here, Mike, and just make a point to the trustees, and I think, James, you can confirm this. So all the coverage that we've had so far in all our cases relate back to our 2014 policy, and we've had approximately $5 million of claims that have been paid. That relates back to the Eddington suit, and the carrier Ulico has agreed that all the subsequent cases have been covered on that claims made 2014 policy. So anything in the future, which is an unrelated claim, there would be a separate, you know, coverage for the first layer of $15 million and then so on and so forth. So I think that claims made is an important aspect to understand how on our claims history, there's still $10 million on that 2014 policy left, but also anything that's unrelated would provide additional coverage, you know, on the first layer of $15 million and so on. So I'm sorry, I didn't miss.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's kind of the note in the third sub-bullet point there. Anything that's related to a earlier claim will relate back and fall in that tower of coverage. And so when you're buying your new insurance, you're not buying any new insurance for things related to the Eddington claim. You're buying a new tower of coverage for future claims unrelated. And then the last issue is who selects defense counsel. This is often a big fight. Under your policy, the insured gets to select the defense counsel if done within 30 days of tendering the claim. Otherwise, the insurer can step in and pay the select the defense counsel. So the fundamental issue in determining what's covered is whether or not something constitutes a claim. When I first started practicing, I thought that this would probably be a very straightforward issue. Something's either a claim or it's not. It's often very murky, and there's a lot of more gray area than you might think. Obviously, a complaint is a claim, but what about a demand letter? Well, it depends on the nature of the demand letters. So on the left-hand side of this chart, you'll see the specific things that are identified as a claim under the policy. Once a claim is made, that's what starts your coverage. So written demands for monetary damages or injunctive relief, that can be something like a demand letter, but Whether a demand letter is specifically seeking monetary damages or injunctive relief isn't always easy to determine. And when you couple that with the reporting provision, you have to be very vigilant about making sure things get tendered to the carrier. And then various civil and criminal proceedings, administrative and regulatory proceedings are also claims. What's not a claim? It would be anything that's an internal proceeding. An informal investigation and proceeding would not qualify as a claim. A request for a tolling agreement, in many D&O policies, you'll see that specifically a claim. If you get a request for a tolling agreement, technically not a claim yet. And a matter which is not alleged, quote, against an insured for a wrongful act. And this is an issue that comes up a lot with proceedings, formal administrative or regulatory proceedings, where they say, oh, we're investigating, we think there might be violations of something, but we're not going to say what those are now. Insurance companies may take the position that that's not for a wrongful act, and we'll talk about wrongful act in a moment, but they'll say this is just a investigation. There's no allegation of wrongdoing yet, so it's not a claim. That can often lead to coverage litigation about whether or not a claim has commenced. So when you think about a claim, the easiest thing to think about is a complaint, so I think we should probably think about it in that framework. The complaint has to be for a wrongful act, and that really lays out the foundation of what is covered, what kind of conduct is covered under a fiduciary liability insurance policy. The fiduciary liability insurance policy has two different definitions of wrongful act. The first is a breach of the responsibilities, obligations, or duties imposed upon insurers by an employee benefit law. And the second is a negligent act, error, or omission by an insured in the administration of any plan. We'll take each of these one by one. The first is a breach of the responsibility, obligations, or duties imposed upon by insurers by an employee benefit law. Employee benefit law is a defined term in the policy. So long as you can connect the alleged wrongful conduct to a statute setting forth the obligations, responsibilities, or duties imposed upon fiduciaries of plans sponsored by public entities or governmental authorities and which your plan is subject to, that's going to be considered a wrongful act. It's not going to depend if it's negligent conduct, intentional conduct. They will all fall within the rubric of a, quote, wrongful act. The slide here shows various examples that are provided in the policy of statutes that could be considered an employee benefit law. I don't think anybody wants me to read through those. But I think the important thing to take away from this first definition of wrongful act is that it includes both intentional and negligent conduct. And anything that would be strictly strict liability as well. It's not about the conduct, it's about whether or not it's an alleged breach of a employee benefit law. The second definition of wrongful act is a negligent act, error, or omission by an insured in the administration of any plan. Unlike the first definition of a wrongful act, this definition is limited to negligent acts, errors, or omissions. So if somebody pleads that conduct was done intentionally in the administration of any plan and does not allege a breach of any employee benefit law, there will likely be a fight over whether or not a wrongful act has been alleged. Administration is a specifically defined term in the policy, and it can involve giving advice to participants and beneficiaries with respect to a trust or plan, interpreting the trust or plan, handling the records, affecting enrollments, terminating or canceling participants, and then eliminating provisions, changing, choosing, terminating of a plan, including benefits, contributions, or changing the level of contribution. So that is sort of what I'll call the outer limits of what can be covered under wrongful acts. And then what the policy will do, and what's probably more important, are the exclusions, which carve back this initial grant of coverage. So what the policies will do is they will pay for loss. from a claim. The first line of loss that you're going to incur is our claim expenses. These are your defense costs. It's also going to provide coverage for certain civil fines and penalties. It specifically states HIPAA, HITECH Act, or the PPACA. So there are provisions in those statutes which can impose civil fines and penalties. This policy will cover those civil fines and penalties, but it will not cover other fines, taxes, or penalties under other statutes. And then finally, it covers monetary damages, judgments, or settlements which an insured is legally obligated to pay as a result of a claim. This basically says that if you settle or if there's a judgment against you, it will qualify as a loss. But the big caveat here is that loss can't otherwise be excluded under the policy. So simply because something is a settlement or a judgment, it doesn't necessarily mean it's covered. You're going to have to look at your exclusions to make sure it's not otherwise covered. So there are going to be two types of exclusions in your policies. One I call full exclusions. That excludes the claim in its entirety, both the indemnity piece as well as the defense cost piece. Then the second type of category of exclusions is going to be exclusions that are related only to the indemnity piece, only to the damages or settlements. It does not affect the right to defense costs. So these are the exclusions that are included in your fiduciary liability policy. Previously noticed claims, that's excluded because if it was previously noticed, it should be handled under a different fiduciary liability policy. Claims for bodily injury, property damage, personal injury, those are claims that would typically go to a CGL policy, so they're not going to cover them under a fiduciary liability policy. pollution exposures, probably not too relevant here, but not going to be covered under a FLI policy, separate line of exposure. Contractual liability is a common exclusion that you'll see in a fiduciary liability policy. If the allegation is that there is a contractual liability, they're not going to pay the claim. However, there's carve-backs for that. Two important carve-backs. If I would have been liable, irregardless of whether or not there was a contract, and that basically the tort system would have provided liability to the same extent as the contract, that claim won't be excluded just because the contract is involved. If the liability would have otherwise existed, the fact that there's a contract shouldn't alter your coverage. And then also liability under the agreement of declaration of trust, which for a pension system is, without that, it would be a gaping hole in your coverage. There's a exclusion for failure to comply with laws governing workers' compensation, unemployment, Social Security, or disability benefits. But there's a big exclusion for that if it's an employee benefit law. If you look at the definition of employee benefit laws, there are several laws relating to workers' comp, unemployment, Social Security, or disability benefits. So that's sort of taken as a case-by-case basis. The last two are really the important ones, I would say. These are the fraud exclusion and the remuneration exclusion. Essentially, under the fraud exclusion, the insurance company is not going to pay for anything that is a deliberately dishonest, fraudulent, or criminal act or omission or an intentional or willful violation of a statute. The important thing to recognize here is that this exclusion only kicks in if there's a final, what we generally call a final adjudication, or if there's an admission as to that fraudulent or intentional conduct. So if there is a allegation of fraud, the insurance company will still have, and assuming it satisfies the definition of a wrongful act, the insurance company will still be obligated to advance defense expenses, but if there's a judgment or a plea agreement or a final adjudication of any sort that establishes that fraud, then they're not going to pay for the claim. The same thing applies with respect to claims where the insured is alleged to gain a financial benefit, profit, remuneration. If you're alleged to gain anything, the insurance company is not going to pay to defend you for your gain. Again, only applies if there's a final adjudication establishing misconduct. The other thing I'll say about these two exclusions that's important is if six trustees are all named, for example, in a lawsuit all alleging fraud, there is a severability of exclusion provision in your policy, which means that you're not going to be tagged. The fraud of one person won't be attributed to other people. Each person's final adjudication is handled on their own, kind of severally. And then there are the defense cost-only exclusions. And this is maybe the most important part of the policy because this carves back significant aspects of a settlement or a judgment. Again, these exclusions do not apply to your claims for defense costs. So you should be defended all the way through, notwithstanding these exclusions. The first one is the failure to fund a plan in accordance with employee benefit law or plan instruments. So they're not going to pay for claims or for settlements or judgments involving the failure to fund a plan. There is an exception to this defense cost exclusion that's of particular relevance to trustees because the exclusion doesn't apply if the trustee or an employee is obligated to pay that settlement or judgment as the personal obligation. So if there is a personal obligation of the trustee, not the plan, to pay as a result of a failure to fund a plan, this exclusion will not apply.
Can we do it here?
The second one is the return to any employer, public entity, or governmental authorities of contributions that can be chargeable to the plan. This falls in the concept of restitution, and they're not going to pay for that. Anything that constitutes benefits due under the terms of the plan or which would be due if the plan complied with all employee benefits laws. Again, this requires that the natural person, to trigger this exclusion, the natural person has to be adjudicated to be personally liable. The interesting thing about this exclusion is that it requires the natural person insured to be adjudicated to be personally liable for the loss, and the loss being based on the wrongful covered act, which means you're not going to be able to avoid the potential application of a fraud exclusion or a remuneration exclusion, because this carve-out specifically requires an adjudication against the natural insured person insured. And then the final exclusion is that this doesn't, the FLI policy doesn't cover losses attributable to breaches resulting in change in values of investments held by the plan. So if there's a claim alleging that mistakes were made that has impacted the value of the investments held by the plan, they'll cover the defense of that litigation, but they're not going to cover a settlement or judgment. One of the things I wanted to note about these defense cost only exclusions is that the two major carve-outs are really only going to apply to judgments. They're not going to apply to a settlement because there's no evidence that the loss is a personal obligation of the insured or that the insured has been actually adjudicated to be personally liable for a settlement. That's only going to really occur if there's a judgment. And so there's certainly going to be tension when the insurance company is going to be hesitant to cover any of these sort of defense cost only exclusion losses, even if there's a natural person insured, because they're going to say that the plan should be, that we don't cover this for the plan, and the exceptions to these exclusions haven't been triggered yet. So these are really judgment issues, less so for settlement, and given that most claims settle, these exceptions typically won't be involved. And then I am happy to answer any questions about my review of the policy or anything that we discussed.
I just have a couple questions. I heard Kelly say that the plan cost has gone up, I think, 350%. And then Josh said it's been at $50 million, even predates him. Does it make sense, looking at the list, to have the $50 million if it seems out of whack looking at the other plans?
So I'm happy to have James address questions about the amount of coverage,
mm-hmm.
because that, as an attorney, that's not my
gotcha.
Wheelhouse. So James, if you want to address.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, we can share information on what other plans consider in their purchasing habits. I think that we're in a difficult position, same from the legal counsel side, to provide a definitive, this is the limit you should be purchasing. It's a consideration to take into account of what the risk exposures are to the plan. I think the important thing to also note is that defense is within the limit of liability. So defense is, when we talk about the $5 million, that is eroding the limits of liability. So these policies are being eroded by defense costs. But to Josh's points earlier as well is that the interrelation of claims also comes into play. So while we're eroding our limit, we also don't have multiple retentions that the board or the individuals would be responsible for in those instances. So there's levers to pull to offset the increases in the market that we're seeing, whether it's reducing limits on the top end or that kind of severity or shock loss exposure, but then also looking at higher retentions, possibly 200,000 to, we have some plans that take on $1 million retentions, $2 million retentions, those types of things, to really just buffer themselves from the pricing shocks in the marketplace.
Okay.
Yeah, and I will say, just in my experience being in the industry, that I have noticed it has been a theme across all lines of insurance, and I'm sure James can confirm this, that premiums have just been skyrocketing over the last few years under virtually all lines of policies. It's just that's the market that it's been in. We host a seminar, and the entire theme of the seminar one year was the hardening market, which meant more expensive coverage, less expansive, more expensive and less expansive coverage. So that's part of the market that we're in.
We've talked to Gallagher and we talked to actually another broker last year and said, give me an example of when we could, of a claim where we could get to $50 million.
Right.
And we could only come up with examples of claims that would cover defense costs. And James has since come up with a couple of claims, but they were under $200,000, you know.
Yeah, because looking at the chart, I think it didn't give the name, but I'm assuming with the number of pensioners and the size of the plan, maybe it was like TRS or ERS. TRS, and you know, theirs wasn't near $50 million.
Right. And this might not be a fair question, so of course don't say it's not a fair question. Because I know, Mike, you don't. You know, we brought you in to do this, and you haven't worked with our specific defined benefit plan. But just as an example, if we had an error where administratively we weren't doing something correct in the plan, such as whatever, the 100% joint survivor, let's say we didn't calculate that correctly, a member came back and sued us for that. I know that the defense costs would be covered. And then if we were found by the court to say, yes, you didn't do this correctly, is the plan, would the insurance been paid for what the members lost because of our failed calculation, or is the plan going to pay that?
So I'll start by reiterating my position. I am a policyholder attorney. I sue insurance companies for a living.
Yeah.
And so it's very rare that I would say something is not covered under a policy. With that in mind, I can tell you that the insurance company is likely to take the position that it's not covered. and that it is, I believe, going back to my the exclusions, it would be a potentially be restitution. If it's money that should have been paid out, that they're going to call that restitution. They're going to say that that's a financial advantage or benefit that has been that the plan as an insured is not legally entitled to. By holding on to money that should have gone out, they're not going to then say, okay, well, we'll pay the benefits that would have otherwise been due under the plan.
So if it's an obligation of the plan, it's still going to be an obligation of the plan if the court decides that. The insurance company's not going to step in and take that over for us. If we owe somebody...
I can do my best to try and get them to, but typically we would not expect an insurance company to pay money that would otherwise be due to...
Okay. Would that include, like, any interest or penalties that a court might assess? Would we think about it the way that an obligation of the plan more than that's something we could look to an insurance company following?
I would say the first line of attack by the insurance company would be the exclusion that this constitutes benefits due under the terms of the plans or which would be due if the plan complied with all employee benefits laws. So that's kind of the first state of why this is excluded. typically, insurance companies don't pay an interest on uncovered loss. As for penalties are excluded under the plan unless they fall within the three statutes that are enumerated, HIPAA, HITECH, or PPACA. The other issue would be whether or not it's a judgment or a settlement. If it's a final judgment or a admission plea agreement, the insurance company is going to take the position that the profit, remuneration, or other advantage exclusion has been triggered, and therefore they don't have an obligation to pay anything. If it's a settlement, you're going to have to convince yourself. If it's a settlement, it's all kind of consensual, and you're going to have to, the insurance company is going to pay what it agrees to pay, and they have consent to settle.
So the other, a couple of things here. One, back to Nick's original question when I was talking, the city indemnity and coverage requirement is mandatory. The city has to indemnify you and defend you and that type of thing under the city code. The second aspect here, which we haven't discussed this, and frankly it's a whole long discussion and it's not Mike's bailiwick, and it would require a whole other set of lawyers to come in or a lawyer to come in, but there's also the aspect of governmental immunity that is another protection for you as trustees and for the pension system that and in some ways, in some aspects, I mean, I think insurance is important, but one of the discussion points, for instance, on the cyber insurance that years ago, I was kind of not that in favor of cyber insurance because of immunity protections that you have, because if you're doing your job and there's a cyber break-in, then, you know, generally, a public pension plan is going to have governmental immunity that you're not going to be liable for damages. Now, I've kind of shifted a little, and a lot of public pension lawyers have shifted a little, and there's a lot of benefits to the insurance, and not just the coverage, but sort of helping you with your system. But in general, immunity will protect some of the claims, including potentially claims for damages, punitives, things like that. Immunity really does a lot for a governmental entity. If you owe money, a court's going to say, yes, you owe money, like because you calculate, to Kelly's question, you calculate something wrong, the person's entitled to a higher benefit, they're absolutely entitled to a higher benefit. But immunity, in most cases, would protect against penalties and things like that if the pension system is simply makes a mistake and calculates something incorrectly. So that's a whole other layer of protection that's out there that we've never really discussed, but it is certainly in... It's in the background, and it's in the forefront of my mind when we talk about some of these insurance questions in general. So,
just also, Josh.
Hey, Josh?
Yeah.
Yeah, quick question. How many claims have we actually had over the years against these policies?
We have had unfortunately, we've had so many. We've had a lot, so it's hard. I'm trying to remember. I think we've had Eddington, Deegan, Jones, the DPROA. I believe there's four that I can recall. There may be a fifth. And Rawlings, right. So there's five cases, I believe, that we've had claims against. And Rawlings also had a bunch of sub-cases involved, but that Rawlings was the main case, and then there was one or two spinoffs, including where our own trustees sued the rest of the board. So there's been five or six cases, so we've had a lot of coverage, and that, you know, that's another sort of point I wanted to make, is that we've had a lot of defense, and still we've only exhausted $5 million. I mean, and you know, we've used the Haynes and Boone firm, and they've done a great job, and they're not inexpensive, but, you know, it takes a lot of litigation to exhaust that amount of money. So that's really, you know, another aspect for the board to consider when you look at these layers and how much protection you have and how much you have in the future. I mean, there's still a fair amount to go on the original 2014 policy, not to mention that, you know, unrelated claims have a whole other $15 million on the first layer.
So I just had a quick question. On the layers, you mentioned, you know, the difficulty of the insurance companies paying at the different layers because, you know, they view that the claim wasn't satisfied down, you know, at the lower layer. So in having these multi-layers with different insurance companies, how likely are you to get the coverage that you're paying for if you have a claim that exceeds, you know, the subsequent layers? Because my experience has been with insurance companies are going to deny, you know, at all levels.
Yeah, in my experience, excess insurance companies will typically follow the primary layer's position, but it's not always. And an easy example here is where you have multiple claims that have all been aggregated into a single claim. And the excess liability carrier says, well, we actually disagree with that legal interpretation of the primary carrier. We think those are separate claims, and they should be treated separately. And therefore, this future claim doesn't relate back to the 2014 policy period. It happens, but as a coverage attorney, as a litigation coverage attorney, I only see the cases where the fight happens. I don't see the cases where it goes smoothly. I do know that in a lot of situations it does go smoothly, and it probably just depends on the carrier and the difficulty of the underlying issue. And frankly, it's not. It's just an issue. It's not an issue inherent to anything with your specific program or your specific carriers. It's just an issue that's inherent to the fundamental concept of excess layers.
Yeah, I mean, some experience, I find, you know, lawyers such as yourself are adept at pulling together everyone into a room and working something out so that insurance companies aren't suing insurance companies down the road. Is that fair in general?
Yeah, that's right. Or that, well, from my perspective, I don't really care if the insurance company sues the insurance company, but as long as there's not a problem with, as long as there's not a gap in coverage or you're stuck getting pulled in two directions, and you're the one suffering. So,
so I guess for us, because we want to move along, the staff would like for us to consider doing something below the 50, and they've recommended a range of 15 to 25. Is that something that people would like to have some time to think about? They're ready to kind of act on it now?
Yeah.
Kelly, what would you like to...
So,
and maybe go to the chart on
the first chart,
page 18.
Yeah, the one that is that this past year or is that the proposed?
This is the right 2022, which actually the renewal period is end 2028.
Summary of that
policy. February 22nd. So this is not the.
So go to the chart. This is the summary
page
of
page 18.
Yeah.
So these are for the current year we're in, and then we'll have a new renewal that starts near the end of February. So we could, right now we've budgeted for these numbers plus 10%. That's what's in the budget at $50 million. We can keep that number in the budget, or we can lower it now and just see where the renewal comes in. I mean, you don't have to make a decision today, because we could have Gallagher go out and still look at getting all the layers and see what it costs.
Do y'all want to do that, or do you want to go ahead and vote on lowering it now?
I'd be happy in lowering it now.
Same here, yeah.
Anyone on the phone feel different?
Well, I guess my question, what's the downside of having you just go out just to check the box that the coverage has gone up significantly and then make the decision to reduce it when we know the...
But has it gone up 350%, as you said, Kelly?
It's gone up 350% from 2014 to 2022, but we will do a new renewal in February. So we're estimating another 10% increase, but that's just an estimate.
Okay. I think
and that's basically because of all the losses we've had. It probably has nothing to do with underwriting
and then
the makeup of the board not doing wrongful acts, because with all the layering and transparency that I see both the IAC and this board, I don't think you're going to see any wrongful acts occurring.
Actually, is it 10% right? I have that right.
Yes.
And James, is it really, we got the 10% from James and Eva, and was that based on our history and the market?
It's a combination of factors that Mike had mentioned, kind of this hardening market, which basically just refers to prices are going up and you're getting less for what you're paying for. We're seeing that across the insurance industry relative to pressure that they see on investment income, claims payouts that they're seeing, natural catastrophe. I mean, the property market and property claims, in a way, impact fiduciary insurance pricing when it's the same carrier that's doing both. So we're seeing pressure from just a macro insurance level. We're also seeing pressure on fiduciary insurance companies when they also write 403B plans, where we're seeing excessive fee litigation come through on 401K and 403B. So there's kind of this confluence of pressure that's coming in addition to the claims experience that's been there in the past. You know, and I think the question might be, well, why do we have all these carriers and $50 million of coverage when it becomes difficult to stack the carriers and get them to pay out? We can't source $50 million of coverage from one carrier. We have to, if we're going to buy coverage, we need to utilize multiple carriers. And that's kind of what's driving this price increase as well, is just the frictional cost as carriers reduce capacity. They're looking at us going, it's going to cost us $20,000 just to kind of write a policy this year, regardless if it's $5 million or $10 million of coverage. So those frictional aspects are what's driving some of the increases as well. We can get the renewal terms and conditions, and at any point in time, the board can decide, and with staff's kind of agreement, can slash limits, so we can have a comparison in the way of it, as well as give options to look at lower limits, but maybe or same limits but higher retention potentially as well. So there's different ways we can look at it, that we can kind of provide this qualitative information for renewal, so that everyone can make a decision at that point.
So I think
can you guys hear me okay?
So I think that the consensus, if any trustee feels, let's go ahead and defer decision on lowering it right now. Bid it. We'll see what it is, but we're very sensitive to lowering it when we have full information, and appreciate the good comprehensive tutorial today. We hope we only see you during tutorials.
yeah.
And we'll just go from there. Everyone on the phone okay with that?
Hey, can you hear me okay? This is Tony.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess my just one quick question. You know, as a new trustee with, you know, a really important milestone coming up next year in terms of the plan kind of restructuring, I mean, how should we be thinking about insurance here as a new trustee, or for any of us, frankly, as trustees?
Well, I think we're all in the same boat, which is that we want to feel protected as long as we operate within a range of integrity
and good governance
and sound practices. And that, you know, they've, Josh has talked to us that we have insurance, we have a city indemnity, we have a plan indemnity. So we have a lot of things out there for us, as long as we operate in good faith. And so I think the consensus is let's not agree to lower it right now. Let's put a placeholder in the budget for the 50 plus with a little bit of an increase, see what it comes back, and then a later meeting, you know, we're very, I guess, sensitive and inclined to perhaps lower it, but we just want to get a little bit more information. Is that okay with everyone right now?
I just have a question for
Sure.
Josh. So is there any case where, I guess I'm just trying to understand when the city would step in, or when a trustee could step into, you know, that particular layer? Is it after we exhaust?
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, so we've never had a situation for any claim that we didn't just go to the insurance company and say, you know, cover the claim, and they handle the defense costs and that type of thing. I suppose that if we exhausted the insurance, we could go to the city and say, okay, now we need you guys to step up and fulfill your indemnity obligation. I think that, you know, it's there. I don't think anyone's suggesting that you shouldn't have any insurance. You should just totally rely on the city, because I think that's fraught with a lot of problems in a lot of different ways. And this board is independent and it needs its own independent coverage.
Okay.
But I think that, you know, you could theoretically at any time go to the city and tap and say, you know, hey, you know, the city code, you know, requires you to indemnify me and defend me. So that
Nancy, one of the ways I look at it is that if the city were to somehow respond in a way that, you know, was contrary to what we think it would or should, you know, it would have a hard time getting volunteers to do things going forward. So I think that's, you know, everyone acting in good faith, everyone thinking about not just today but tomorrow. I mean, I feel good about it. I've, you know, engaged with insurance like this several times in my career, and you know, I feel like this, that we're well protected, and very sensitive to doing our part on something that seems like an outlier. Looks like level coverage perhaps is an outlier, so we're inclined to go ahead and lower it, but let's just get the renewal premiums as a final confirmation before we do that. Yeah. So is everyone good with that?
I am.
Yeah. Okay.
I just have another question. Are the layers that you identify, are those the natural layers that insurance companies, these bands, or do you have flexibility in expanding those bands, or is that just insurance company related?
The ability to expand them has changed over the last few years. You know, traditionally $5 million is probably the least amount of coverage that one of these carriers is doing. But, you know, historically, and I think it's important too, is in 2014, the policy that was in place, Markel actually wrote two policies for us. So we have $25 million of coverage with the same carrier, which now has become kind of some of that pressure that we've seen where Markel is trying to limit their exposure, reduce it to 15, and now we're having to purchase $10 million chunks above and beyond that, with $5 million on that last layer. So kind of 25, $10 million is the new $25 million, if you will, on some of this, and that's fiduciary, commercial general liability, umbrella insurance, D&O, kind of the world of insurance is getting to more of those smaller, finite layers.
In general, when you see the name Markel, that means there's not a lot of competition. They like to go to places where, you know, other people don't traffic, and so when you see them, that means you didn't have 50 bids. Is that generally right?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, these are the carriers that we typically see playing on this. And for the National Union Fire is actually AIG. It's one of their writing companies. But yeah, the carriers that you're seeing here kind of play more in that private company or public company D&O fiduciary. Some of the harder policies to place from from what they see as from a liability perspective.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and move on. Do we still want to make that time switch, but we're later now, or not?
I
want to do Brenda first, then Ryan, or Ryan and Brenda?
I think we'll do Ryan first, and then if we need to.
Okay.
If Ryan, if you want to switch the order of your private assets and fixed income.
We'll see how we're doing.
Okay. We have a little scheduling thing.
So you want to go ahead and go Ryan now?
Yeah.
I'll start.
All right.
We need to move something after that.
Thank you both for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank
Mike,
you.
Come on up.
Ryan, go ahead and start.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, so we've
Thank
got
you.
The portfolio update and then a few. Bill, I heard you at the top. Okay. We got the portfolio update, and then Mike will do a review of the public fixed income portfolio.
Portfolio update is on 45.
And then we have our normal quarterly private asset cash flow review, and I'm going to spend a bit more time on that with the new trustees on what we're actually covering there and what goes into those that model. So on the portfolio update, I'll start, as always, with liquidations of private market assets. We're at about $54 million received year-to-date through September. We actually have about $37 million more that should be coming, like, in the next couple weeks. There's a big AEW distribution that we're just kind of figuring out a few things on how to distribute that, but that sale has occurred and that money is sitting there ready to distribute, and then there's a sale in the Lone Star portfolio that should be coming back by the end of October, I'd say. As a reminder, we put the safety reserve in the drawdown mode at the March board meeting. We have a slide covering kind of where we sit at there a little bit later. Wanted to update you guys that in September we received the Huff Energy year-end audit. And as you guys know, every year that's the one that comes in delays and holds up the financials. The value of that was $66 million on our books, and it tripled to like $193. And the increase was somewhat expected just based on the future prices of oil and gas. That valuation has historically been very volatile and swings from, you know, 50 to 120 down to 80. And it's been all over the map, so not unexpected, but definitely a very volatile valuation. They follow the same process as in prior years where they have an engineer report, independent valuation, and audit. So. And then subsequently, we got the Q2 valuation. So in September, we actually went from 66 to 193 back to 174. So 174 is the value you would see in these reports on that. So wanted to let you know we've gotten that. The value went up quite a bit. And you'll see in some of these slides how that affects, you know, everything else in the reports. And then also we booked the Lone Star internal valuations, and the value of the CRA fund, which is the only one that we're putting a value on as of now, went from 39 to 66. So two pretty significant write-ups in the private equity portfolio. So rebalancing, we moved $30 million from short-term core bonds over to cash. So stayed within the safe reserve, but just replenished the cash balance, which gives us enough cash to pay benefits and kind of end up around the 3% target by year-end. And then the Ashmore EM debt investment, we redeemed that at the end of September, and then we funded the new investment with MetLife, the new EM debt manager. And then with these proceeds that are coming in, the plan there is to redeploy those into the equity portfolio, most likely into small cap. But since we've been in the drawdown mode on the safety reserve, we've been checking in with the IAC before we do a rebalance and to say, here's what we talked about in July, here's what we plan to do. You know, if you guys want to talk, it's one additional step to check in with them before we're moving money around. So year-to-date return is down negative 8.2% for the overall portfolio and down 19.2% for the public market portion of the portfolio. So we ended September at $1.75 billion in assets. This is a bridge chart showing that, you know, through September we're down about $78 million from benefit outflows, and then down $159 in depreciation of the investments on the books. So looking at the equity market drawdown, this is as of Tuesday, I guess. Don't look today, but it shows kind of where we're at. We're, I think, now at lows again, pretty much across the board. S&P is down 25%. Acqui Global Stocks, which is what we benchmark to in the equity portfolio, is down 26.5%. And you can see EM and tech
NASDAQ there at the bottom of the chart.
So this is the chart we've been showing since the beginning of the year. As we get closer to the end of the year, that, you know, we don't expect it to end up positive, but I think what it's showing is the red dot is the average or the end of year worst decline for that year, calendar year, and then what the ending annual return for that year ended up being. And so I think what's significant now is this is the sixth worst decline since 1980, entry year. So it's pretty significant. But looking at the public market performance snapshot, this is makes up about 60% of the portfolio. We're down 19.2% compared to a benchmark that's down 24 for 60-40. I'm looking at the middle column, the year-to-date is what we're mainly focused on. Same kind of story with the value managers outperforming and then the growth managers with Invesco and Walter Scott underperforming the core benchmark. Small cap down there at the bottom is getting hit a little bit harder than the global equity managers, and then RBC, the EM equity managers, holding up relatively well against the benchmark, outperforming by 2.5. And the big outperformance compared to the 60-40 is still coming from the fixed income portfolio, and that's mainly due to the fact that we're largely U.S.-focused outside of EM debt, and we have a shorter duration in the benchmark. So the benchmark's down 19.8%, and our fixed income's down 12.9% so far year-to-date. And then if you look at the three-year number on the 60-40 now, it, up there top right, a 60-40 global portfolio is now flat for a three-year period. So I doubt there's that many rolling three-year periods where you have zero return on a 60-40. So, any questions on any of the specific managers we're showing here?
I think it's important to note that private market returns are not measured the same way that, privates and publics are different, in that private investments have a lot more subjectivity.
Yeah.
There's a time lag issue, and there's an ability to insert all sorts of caveats into it in a way that if you look at a private market number for a time period and look at a public and try to draw a clear analogy, I wouldn't say that's a good comparison.
Yeah.
And we can kind of debate, you know, how clear or unclear it is, but, you know, the public market basically votes every day, and we see those prices. We have a, you know,
a mark-to-mark.
A tough CPI print today,
yeah.
The market's down. These private equity firms have to do quarterly and then annual valuations. There's a lot of subjectivity in those. So, you know, typically on privates, you look over an extended period of time. You know, I tend to look at more multiple of return to what the investment is. So, you know, when I look at the year-to-date or the 2021 private number, I don't think, like, that number is apples and apples with our public number. So, and I think generally other people here who have experience would agree with all that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, it's already kind of queuing it up right now, just given the timing of the markups. And if anyone wants to kind of dig into that valuation deeper, just let me and Kelly know, and we can.
Now, the one thing I would say that is a real positive that, in general, those of us are in the private markets, you know, we're not seeing a ton of liquidity right now. So the fact that you have been able to generate liquidity, I know some of that's outside your control, but some of it is, you know, the result of multiple years' efforts in a lot of different ways, whether, you know, it's what's happened with Lone Star or whatever. So I really do want to sort of commend the team, and it really has been the whole team. I mean, Ryan, but I mean, everyone's been knee-deep in this stuff for several years, and, you know, the liquidity that you're generating right now is extremely helpful when we look at the safety reserve, we look at the markets, and so on. So, you know, you'll see other people have to sell illiquid securities and so on, which, you know, that's typically done at bargain prices and so on, and we're not in a situation. We were a couple of years ago. We had to do a lot of that stuff, but we're not having to do that right now, and I really commend the staff for the fact that we're not having to do it right now.
I'll flip ahead to the state reserve slide for talking about it. And I think the benefit of having the proceeds come back in Q3 and a big chunk coming back in the next month is we've been able to replenish some of the state reserve kind of through halfway through the year and then been able to take some of those proceeds and buy into the equity markets and, you know, a bit of weakness and plan to do that going forward. So right now we're at 133 in the state reserve, 54 in cash, or 79 in cash and 54 in the iron and short-term core bond portfolio. That will be enough if we don't do any replenishing of it to pay benefits through November of 2023. As I mentioned, we talked to the board and the IC in July and started putting some of these proceeds back to work in the equity portfolio. So there's kind of been a dual benefit of not having to sell equities to pay benefits and then also actually putting some money back to work. Looking at the bottom right chart there showing the expected cash flow. So right now we have about a $79 million cash balance. First two lines there are showing the MetLife funding and the Ashmore redemption. We just got the money back yesterday from Ashmore. And then with the expected benefit outflows through year end, we should end the year at about $54 million in cash. So the $30 million we just transferred over kind of helped us bridge that MetLife funding and then gave us enough cash to be at target by year end. And then kind of going back to the public and private market performance, this is a chart that we've shown kind of throughout the year in 2021, and I wanted, kind of given the big differences in public and private performance right now, I wanted to show the return contribution from the public portfolio versus the private. So just talking through the 2021 number, which is the final year-end number, the table at the bottom would show that our average allocation to private markets in 2021 was 31%. That portfolio returned 6.1%, so the contribution to the return was -1.9%. So private markets were a 2% drag on the overall portfolio return. On the other hand, the public markets portfolio, equity, fixed income, and cash, was about 69% of the portfolio. That returned 10, contributed 7% to the return, so the overall return ended up being 5%. As we talked about with the and this all happened on the 2022 in the last quarter, with last month with those write-ups. The public portfolio, which is over two-thirds now, is down almost 20%, and then the private portfolio is up 17.5%. So it's kind of bringing that overall return up by 5% compared to what we're seeing in the public portfolio. So we'll kind of everything's static on the prior year, but we'll keep updating this through year end. Show you that effect. This is the asset allocation detail where we're giving detail in the equity portfolio, and that column in the middle there with the colors on it is showing that where we're at on each of the equity managers compared to their target. You can see the two small cap managers that we funded in the last year. We initially funded kind of halfway up. They're the most underweight to the target, so that's where we plan to put money, but we'll, again, check in with the IAC before we redeploy that. Going ahead to the board investment review plan, Mike is going to cover the fixed income portfolio today. November, we're going to come back and cover the public equity portfolio. And then in December, we'll do a review of, you know, you hear the two main ones all the time, but the private equity and private debt portfolios. So any questions from the board before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, the most profound thing you said is that three-year returns for risk assets are basically break-even. And that's an index, that's not, you know, us. And then, you know, every pension plan in the country, you know, is compounding that liability at 6, 6.5, 7, 7.5%. So that's just, you know, that's an industry-wide poll on what now the three-year return on risk assets are. So, I mean, that's a real, there's just no place to hide.
Yeah.
And, I mean, everything we look at here is backward-looking, but if you look at, looking forward, you know, go forward returns after, you know, in a bear market are pretty good on the equity side, and now we're able to make yield in the fixed income portfolio. So though we're down quite a bit, if you look the go forward, you know, once you get through the however long this takes, it bodes well for go forward returns, I would say.
Yeah, but I'm saying everyone on a 3-year basis, their years to break even, that number, you know, every, you know, with only a few exceptions, has extended because of these market returns.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to the next item. quick report on the IAC meeting from September 22nd. So we covered at that meeting some private market considerations. We've been talking about, you know, sometime in the next 12 to 18 months, we're going to start likely redeploying money into private markets. That's not something we've done since 2016. So initial conversation with the IAC is on some considerations we need to think about there, and then we plan to bring an item back to the board in November to talk about policies, procedures, governance, how we want to go about doing that. And then we also talked about diligence process for our current managers and new managers and what we want to do in terms of on-site diligence. We haven't done anything kind of since COVID. So the feedback there was on new manager searches, we haven't done on-site the last kind of three or four. We'd like to do that going forward when we have new manager searches and then try to get out to see our public managers at least once every 3 years.
Bill chaired this meeting, right?
So yeah.
Bill, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, I think the bulk of the meeting we spent talking about that if we get money back from Huff and Lone Star, we'll start to fall below our private equity targets. And even though that's probably 12 to 18 months out, we should start thinking about issues like pacing, diversification, how do we invest those funds. There was a discussion on secondaries. So we really asked staff and Makita to start thinking through all of those issues so that we can have them on the table over the next 6 months so that when we get ready to invest, we'll be ready to go. So it was a good meeting, and I think there's a lot of work to be done between now and then.
And, Ryan, you said that our engagement with Makita does not cover them weighing in on private opportunities. So that's something else that you guys need to discuss and that we need to discuss.
Yeah, and like this November, we'll kind of review what we talked to the IFC about and then what we need to do. And I think a lot of it is getting some feedback from the board and then working that into plan to do a consultant RFP in 2023 and figure out how we're working with them on the private markets side as well.
Hey, this is Tony. I have a quick question about that. So,
yeah.
You know, in the past, I think, you know, a lot of the private market returns or lack thereof were more driven by manager selection than the asset class in general. And so if we are looking to start to deploy money more into those asset classes, how do we think about sourcing those opportunities? I mean, how much do we rely on Makita, or how much do we rely on, you know, networks that we have, or, you know, how do we source, you know, new go forward true private market or private equity opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think it's something we need to think a lot about. You know, we internally haven't done anything new since 2016, so I would imagine maybe at first we're relying more on the consultant and working through that process and then run before we walk. And, you know, that's how we start to build it out. One thing we talked to the IAC about, just since we have we haven't made a new commitment since 16, is does a secondary fund make sense to kind of backfill and get some initial exposure to private equity instead of starting from scratch in that portfolio? So,
and the other point we've had is concentration of investments. And one of the key things we'll be looking at is diversification among managers and sectors and not being concentrated like we are in Lone Star with a major percentage of the fund. So those are all the issues that are going to be sorted. But I think Brian's right. I think we're going to some extent, rely on Makita to do a lot of the sourcing for us at the beginning.
Yeah, and I think Nick has had some really insightful comments, you know, in general, just about, you know, private equity or, you know, private asset returns. But as you think about overall asset allocation and future, you know, returns and target returns and trying to make up deficits, you know, an allocation to private equity is critical. And a lot of the higher performing pension plans are going to have, you know, meaningful allocation there. And, you know, we're coming from such a different place with, you know, the uniqueness of decisions that were made in the past, but they're such low hanging fruit and so, you know, such easy return in private equity with really well-known, steady managers that when you think about future returns, I mean, it's so hard to see how we can generate any meaningful return without a reasonable allocation there. So more just curious about how we think about sourcing and ultimately, you know, allocating up to that over time.
All we can be certain is we'll do it differently than it was done in the past. I think we can all agree on that.
I don't know. Private equity is not out of the park.
And we're in agreement that allocation of private assets is critical to growing the portfolio.
Sure.
I mean, it's just
right.
we just had some bad choices.
Yeah. What I wanted to add is we're in my mind, the way I'm looking at this private equity next stage for DPFP is it's a whole new program, and we need to build it up as if it's a whole new program. So we need to define what is the consultant's role, what's our role, what's the pacing plan, what's the approval process, what's the size, what's the policies all around it. And we just need to, you know, we need to develop a private equity program.
Private equity perhaps and likely is a subset of it. It's
yeah.
really illiquid investing
right.
into illiquid asset classes, and there's a lot of things in that bucket that go beyond
just
private equity. Yeah,
private equity.
And so defining all that, and we should look. We should be very excited about looking into that, you know, process and figuring out what makes sense for us, with due recognition to multiple layers of scar tissue that exist everywhere we look.
You know exactly what not to do. So. But yeah, I mean, when we talk about private equity, we're really talking about 15% allocation to private markets, which is 5% private equity, 5% real estate, and 5% natural resources, which is the Hancock Ag portfolio. And we had a little bit of discussion at ISD around is that the right level and why was it 15? And, you know, we were so far away from that actual allocation when we did that allocation in 17 and 18. So
it's actually
yeah.
performed well.
Yeah. Okay, so we got one more item, and then we'll hand it off to Mike. So we have a few recommended IPS revisions. One of them deals with the IAC, and so there's currently three board members on the IAC, and in the policy there's a maximum of three. Nancy, you know, was on the IAC as an outside member before she became a board member, and she would like to continue to serve on the IAC. So in order to do that, we need to remove the cap on the maximum number of board members on the IAC. We'll have a separate item later to appoint her. But one thing we talked about doing is we've had this quorum issue where the statute says there needs to be a majority of outside members of the IAC, and we have five now with Gilbert or Nancy coming on and Gilbert going off. So we have five outside members, and with this change, we would have four board members. So if any outside member cannot attend a board meeting or IAC meeting, then we don't have a quorum. So the fix for that is we're going to rotate board members on the IAC that can attend but not participate in the meeting to get a quorum to make sure we're actually able to hold a meeting with a quorum. We did it actually last meeting with Ken, who was kind enough to observe the discussion and attend. And so the plan would be
I'll shed for more than 10 minutes.
Impressive. So that would be the plan going forward to ensure we have a quorum, but also ensure we have the right expertise from the board serving on that committee. So any questions about what we're doing there?
Well, we're thrilled that we can facilitate Nancy staying on, but also we just think about that as being a natural pathway to the board. We want to create, you know, something that is sustainable over time because that's a way, you know, what better way to incubate quality trustees than working on the IAC or things similar to that. So
definitely.
We thought that was a great solution, specifically to Nancy and then in general.
Thank you, Nancy. Okay, the other
Do
minor.
Do we need a motion on that?
Well, I'm going to talk about one other quick minor change, and we've already made this change on the Makita reports, and since we're reopening the IPS, I just want to do a fix there. But the private equity benchmark has been the Cambridge Associates U.S. All Private Equity on a quarter lag benchmark for a long time. Cambridge owns that benchmark data, and they've kind of gone back to J.P. Morgan's of the world, the custodians and the consultants, and are requesting that the end users pay for that benchmark. And, you know, where we're at right now, it does not make sense to pay for it. It's, you know, multiple thousands of dollars to get that benchmark. So what we've done is switched to a public proxy, which is the Russell 3000 plus 2% on a quarter lag. So Makita actually made a change, leaving their Q2 report, and we've talked about it before with the board, but since we're reopening the IPS, we want to make that tweak there.
So Makita,
Ryan, I think this makes a lot of sense because we couldn't access a lot of the people that are in the index, the Cambridge index, given our size and scope and materiality. And what we're really trying to do is add value relative to what we're doing in the public market. So I think this is a change that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and Makita still has access to it, but we can't use it in our report.
Well, I mean, what Bill says makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe down the road we would look at it again once we're actually actively doing private equity, but since we're not, it makes no sense to pay for it.
Yeah.
So staff recommendation would be to approve those two changes to the IPS.
Can we have a motion?
Move.
Second?
Mm-hmm.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries.
All right. On to Mike to review
the
public
thing. Should I move if I'm on the committee? I mean, like, is that okay for
me?
That's
fine. Well, this one is just changing the policy.
Okay.
And
since
then
I'm a member of it, does it?
It's okay.
Okay.
And then later we have an item to appoint Nancy to the committee.
Okay.
But and you can vote on anything.
Okay.
In this agenda.
Okay.
All right. On to Mike.
Great. All right, everyone. Mike, Senior Investment Officer, we'll be going over the fixed income portfolio. So just before we start, I want to go over a couple of key points to take away from this. As we alluded to earlier, markets have been down. Bonds are down this year. On the flip side, positive is that yields are up. We have outperformed the benchmark, given that we're overweight short duration. The safety reserve is in a drawdown currently, and we did make a switch at managers at EM Debt. Start with the asset allocation. So we have a 25% allocation to fixed income, including our cash. You can see here that the safety reserve makes up 9%, and then we have 4 to investment-grade bonds, and then for credit, we have 4 to bank loans, 4 to high yield, and 4 to EM Debt. I'd like to note here we're a little bit overweight cash and a little bit underweight short-term investment grade as we're drawing down the safety reserve. This slide shows the milestones that have been made and all the progress we've made since the new board has been in place. I'm going to touch on some recent ones. In July 2021, we reduced the safety reserve from 15% to 9%. In March of 2022, we initiated the drawdown on the safety reserve. And in October 2022, we replaced Ashmore EM Debt with MetLife EM Debt.
I would say there's a lot on the slide, but like you look at the current roster in the fixed income portfolio, it's basically completely turned over the last 5 years. The Pacific is the longest serving strategy in the portfolio with the 2016 inception. Loomis, we switched strategies there, so pretty much kind of restructured the entire fixed income portfolio on the public side.
We'll touch on portfolio performance and characteristics. I want to note here the dates. So the official numbers that we've gotten from Makita are 8/31, so the top chart, and then the two columns on the right and the bottom. And then we have characteristic numbers from the managers as of 9/30. So if there's discrepancy from what we looked at earlier, that's why. As we see, bonds have had a rough year. As Brian alluded to earlier, we're down 12.9%. The index is down 19.8%. So over outperformance due to that overweight and short-term IG. I want to look at the yields right now on the bottom chart. So you can see that yields are up this year relative to last year significantly. Our short-term investment grade is at 5.1%. Our core investment grade is at 5.3%. Bank loans is at 10%, and high yield is at 8.7%. Our fixed income portfolio as a whole is yielding 6.6% relative to the benchmark at 3.3%. And that is up from last year, just to give a relative measure. Our portfolio was at a 2.1% yield last year, and the benchmark was at a 1.3% yield. So collecting a lot more yield on fixed income now.
take a look at duration real quick. Short-term investment grade is going to have a low duration of 1.8. Core is going to be our highest duration of Longfellow, 6.1. Bank loans, obviously minimal duration, so 0.4 given their floating rate. And U.S. high yield is at 3.8. Our investment grade portfolios, average quality is investment grade at A+ and AA. And our two credit higher yielding managers are at B and B+. I'm going to dive through each manager real quick. Send me the question.
I think it was just feedback.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go through each manager real quickly. These slides will have, the first one will be a summary on the manager and the asset class, and then the second slide will be performance. So first we've got IRM. It's short-term investment grade bonds, our most stable asset class. The goal here is to generate a little bit of yield while preserving our liquidity. Again, we're currently drawing on this bucket and payments for benefit payments, and that will cover those payments until the fourth quarter of 2023. Now, this asset class has had probably one of the worst drawdowns in its history this year, but as you can see, it's still pretty safe given that it's only down about 5% year-to-date. We have been drawing on this for benefit payments, and we did draw on this asset class in March of 2020 for liquidity, and in both instances, there have been no liquidity issues for withdrawing funds. Next, we have Longfellow, which is our core investment-grade bond portfolio. Very similar to IRM, except we have longer duration, which means more duration and more sensitivity to changes in interest rates. You can see that we are affected here by that duration, as year-to-date returns have been about negative 14% for both the index and Longfellow.
How do they manage duration compared to the benchmark? Do they take any, like, a whole lot of duration bets, or are they pretty close?
No, they're pretty duration neutral.
Okay.
This is Pacific, our bank loan manager. So bank loans have higher credit risk, but also higher yields. They also are floating rate, so they have minimal duration, which we will see that played out in the performance. This is actually one of DPFT's best performing asset classes in fixed income due to that minimal duration. You can see Pacific is down 3.1% year-to-date versus the benchmark at 3.3. Pacific also will protect on credit risk given its relative quality bias in the strategy. Moving on to Loomis High Yield. The U.S. high yield portfolio has higher credit risk with higher yields. However, the difference between Loomis and Pacific is that high-yield bonds are fixed-rate investments, so they will have duration risk. This asset class has been hit hard this year given the exposure to duration and credit risk, as high-yield has been hit by higher rates and credit deterioration. You can see Loomis is down 15.2% this year, and the benchmark is down 14.7%. Our last manager is our most recent addition, MetLife Blended EM Debt. MetLife invests in emerging market debt across local, hard, and corporate bonds. They also manage FX exposure within the portfolio. This is the new manager that replaced Ashmore EM Debt in early October. MetLife was selected for their experience, stable investment team, true EM debt blended allocation, their in-depth credit research, and they had the best overall trailing performance out of all of our semifinalists. Have any questions?
All right.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.
Brian, do you want to do your next time, or do you want to skip it?
Yeah, let's just go through it.
Okay.
All right, so this is the quarterly review of the private asset cash flows, and as I said earlier, I want to spend a bit more time just kind of the new board members talking about what we're doing here and why we're doing it. And, so we present this in the first month of every quarter. We've been doing it since the beginning of 2018. What we do is staff builds up by asset, here's the entire private asset portfolio, and then looks forward on a quarterly basis. When do we expect distributions to come back from each individual asset? And ag, real estate, directly owned assets, we have a lot more visibility and, a little bit of control over what occurs on some of the private equity and private equity infrastructure funds. We're smaller investors in a big fund, and, we're more taking we expect this fund to liquidate over the next 3 years. So we're taking an even approach to we're going to get a third back. So, and some of the confidential closed session materials, there's a detailed schedule that lists every asset and when we expect proceeds to come back, and then there's also a presentation that talks about what each asset is at a high level and how we're coming up with those assumptions. If it's based on an individual sale or we're just taking a two-year or even approach. So, and that detailed schedule is on page 113 of Diligent if you want to take a look at that. So this is showing where we're at on private markets today or as of 9:30 compared to what we had at end of Q3 of 16, so 6 years of experience here. We've had $1.2 billion in private asset distributions, $245 million in capital calls, and then a change in market value of $128, which has all occurred in the last month on the two private equity write-ups we talked about earlier. This is looking since the new board formation, so we have about $800 million of those distributions have occurred since September of 17. This page is showing you what actually occurred during Q3. Q3, we have very little unfunded capital remaining in the private equity portfolio, so we have periodic capital calls on a few of the private equity funds, mainly in the Aero infrastructure funds, and then this is BTG Pactual, which is the directly owned timber portfolio. We've had to fund a few times this year to support operations there. Looking at the distributions in Q3, we had about $29 million in distributions, big ones being the L&B property sale that occurred in July. And it was actually a pretty decent markup compared to where we were carrying that one at. The Huff Alternative Fund, the last remaining asset in that fund was a property in Vegas on the strip that they sold. We got $8.2 million from that. And that's the first bit of money that's come back that we actually redeployed into small cap. We did that in August. And then we had the two sales that occurred in the Lone Star portfolio in early July, and then a small distribution from Industry Ventures, which is the venture capital fund of funds that we invested in.
Yeah.
Chart is showing quarterly activity. Was there a question there? Okay. This is showing quarterly activity going back to Q4 of 16, blue bars going up being total distributions in the quarter, and then orange is capital calls, and then kind of the cumulative amount on the dotted line across the top there. So earlier on in 16 and 17, those were the big secondary sales we had to do for liquidity back then, so quite a bit more activity. And then the last 3 years, the activity kind of ebbed and flowed with very little activity during COVID, and then quite a bit in 2021, and then a little bit slow so far this year. So this chart here is showing the output. So this blue dotted line, this blue line is the same line that you see on the previous chart, and then we extrapolate it forward based on the assumptions we have for Q4, 22, all of 23, and then we actually added 24 into the mix this time. And then you can see the line increasing in slope there is the assumption in the model is that Huff is going to sell in 2023. So, with Huff, we don't know what the ultimate value will end up being, but when it sells, it's all one big operating company, so we expect the proceeds to come back in one chunk. And that kind of goes into the private equity pacing. And we know at some point down the road we're going to do new private equity and new real estate, but just allocation-wise, until we get material amounts back from Huff, Lone Star, and RCH. Those are the three big drivers to getting us back down to the target allocation. And so the $28 million that we received in Q4 or Q3, you know, as I, going forward, it should be, we expect it to be lumpier than it's been in the past, where we had more assets and more regular sales on the real estate side. We're down to, you know, a fewer number of assets and a higher concentration in what's left, where, you know, the exposure is more concentrated in the three big names that I just mentioned. And then when I talk about the lumpiness, you know, I expect to get more distributions in the next month than we got probably in the first half of the year. So we, you know, got $28 million last quarter. We'll probably get $25 million in one distribution next week. So it should just be a bit chunkier when it comes back. So when we talk about legacy assets, what we are talking about there is in 17, you know, we had the schedule and we went through what are the assets that are going to be more complex. We might have management issues on them, harder to sell assets. So on the detailed schedule, anything that's highlighted yellow goes into that legacy category. And it's a mix of the private equity we talk about and then AEW, which is good management on a complex asset. So it's not all, you know, bad or all good, but it's all complex and harder to sell. So this is showing what portion of the private asset portfolio is in that legacy bucket versus non-legacy, and then how we expect that to resolve over time. So about two-thirds of the portfolio, the private portfolio, is in that legacy bucket, and about 25% of DPFP is in that bucket. Another assumption we make on legacy is that it's going to be a zero return on those assets going forward, and that kind of goes into our go-forward actuarial return assumption and stepping up to a 6.5 return where, you know, we kind of take 5 to 5.5 and step up to that ultimate return assumption. This is looking at the private asset allocation over time. We're at about 37% at the end of September. You know, that spike that you see is really the denominator effect of the public asset values going down, and then the big write-ups in the private equity. That, you know, Q1 it spiked because of the denominator effect, and the Q2 went up further because of dual effect of public asset values going down, and then the private equity write-ups that occurred. But if you look all the way back to 16, we were at 1.2-thirds private assets, so we've made considerable progress towards that target of 15. That wraps up the private asset review. When we do it next time in January, we'll do kind of recap 2022 and what sold during the year versus what we assumed would sell at the beginning of the year. So, any questions on that report?
Good job on generating some liquidity.
Exactly. we'll try to keep it going, but we got good visibility for the next month, at least.
Brenda, I've always liked that phrase, initial reading. It's like a play or a book or something. going to do a budget. So we're now going to turn it over to you for an initial reading.
Okay.
Of the 2023 budget.
I'll go backwards here. Bear with me. Or John, can you help me get back there faster than
27
I'm?
27 or 28.
Perfect. Thank you.
Oh, just I'm sorry for you. On the private assets, Mike just sent me the distribution notice. We got $10 million back from the Maritime Fund. We're getting that back in addition to what we...
Wow. Like just
right now, like look just, what Mike did.
Yeah. Well,
it's all up.
No.
It's raining.
Yeah. Sorry.
No worries. Thank you, Nick. Morning, everyone. Today I am doing the initial reading of the proposed 2023 budget. And I thought I would start today by just going through, for those of you who may not be familiar with the budget process, what does the budget process look like for DPFP? The system does have a budget adoption policy. It is located in Diligent in the Resource Center. If you want to read the policy, I'm going to quickly kind of go through some highlights. The system's budget year is January through December. The annual proposed budget is first presented to the board in every October. And at the October meeting, the board may propose changes to the budget. Additionally, the board will authorize the budget to be posted to the website and to be sent to the City of Dallas. Now, the City of Dallas officials may request changes to the board, but it is this board that makes the final determination on any expenses. At the November meeting, we will have the second reading of the budget. Members will be given the opportunity to comment on the proposed budget, and the board or staff may propose changes. Also during the November meeting, the board can approve the budget, or they can direct the staff to make adjustments and bring the revised budget back again in December for the final approval. So you'll see the budget at least two times in October and November, and you may see it again in December if we are making additional adjustments. But it will need to be approved at the December meeting. At any time during the year, the staff can recommend budget changes, but the board has to approve any budget changes that are recommended. And finally, each August, I will present a detailed mid-year analysis of actual expenditures versus the budget, and I'll present that to the board. So just a quick overview, that's what you can expect from the budget process each year. So let's take a look at the 2023 budget. We're going to start by looking at some assumptions. Then we'll look at the summary budget, review the detailed budget, look at some variances on specific accounts, and finally look at some expense trends. So let's start with just some budget assumptions. Most renewing service arrangements like utilities, janitorial, subscriptions, the feedback we've received from these vendors was to expect increases. And so they have been those items have been budgeted with an expected 5% increase. Staff and board, travel, training, conference registration, those budgets have remained fairly constant year over year. We have not budgeted any public relations expense for 2023. And risk insurance that we talked about earlier is quoted and budgeted at the current levels, which includes the $50 million in fiduciary insurance. And the blended increase there over all the lines is 11.7%. And again, as Kelly talked about earlier, just the overall expense since 2019 on risk insurance, all the lines increase of 56.5% since 2019. So it is, again, after salaries and benefits, it is our next biggest item, and it is increasing significantly every year. For staffing and benefits, we are projecting a staff level of 23, which is down from 225 that we had projected for last year. Per the system compensation policy, CBIZ, who is the compensation consulting expert, submitted their annual letter to us, salary structure letter, and the letter included items like CPI is 8.5%. Their structure or range recommendation was 5.3%, so to move our ranges, 5.3%. And then their salary increase recommendation was 6.5% to 8.3%. And for the purpose of the budget, we've used 8.3% for salary increases. Health insurance was quoted with preliminary market increase of 10 to 12%. For the budget, we've used the 12% number with the expectation that employee deductions would also increase by 12% to keep that same employee-employer ratio of expense sharing. Most other benefit costs, like dental, vision, life, we have projected those with increases in the 5 to 10% range. So that kind of sets the stage. That's where we started from. So now let's kind of dig into what the numbers look like. Here on page 29, if you're following along on the phone, this is the summary budget schedule. We track three broad categories of expenses, administrative. Administrative, investment, and professional. So you'll see that on the left-hand side of the schedule. And you'll have the columns are the 2022 budget, so last year's budget, our 2022 projected actual, the 2023 budget, and then variances comparing the two budget years and then comparing 2023 to the 2022 projected actual, both in dollars and percentage. And you'll see all of the subsequent schedules will kind of follow this same format as we go through. So if we look at the big picture, the total budget for 2023 is $18.2 million. And that compares to $21.7 million for the 2022 budget, so down almost $3.5 million or 16%. And that decline is primarily driven by declines in management fees. And when you compare the 2023 budget to the 2022 projected actual of $18.8 million, we're down $577,000 or 3%, and that's driven primarily by declines in investment-related expenses that are partially offset by increases in administrative and professional expenses. And just one other comparison, if you look at the 2022 projected actual of $18.8 million, is under the 2022 budget of $21.7 million by $2.9 million, and again, lower than expected investment management fees are driving that change. So let's move to the next page, page 30. Here on the next two pages, this is our detailed line item budget. So it's every line item in the budget is broken down by our three main categories with those same comparisons both in dollar and in percentage. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this particular schedule because we'll look at many of these items as we go over the variance schedules, but I just want you to know this schedule lists every expense, every variance with the comparisons. So feel free to peruse that at your leisure, and if you have a question, you know, please feel free to reach out to me. As we go to the next page, just one thing I want to call your attention to is at the bottom of page 31 is the supplemental budget. So we have a regular plan and a supplemental plan, or the combined plan and the supplemental plan. We do allocate 0.85% of our total expenses to the supplemental plan. To the supplemental plan. As we move on to page 32, this slide and the next slide, we'll drill down into the year-over-year changes in the various budget or actual categories. Our criteria to look at these variances were that the variance had to be at least $25,000 and at least 5%. So let's start looking at just comparing the two budgets, 2022 versus 2023. And in the top section is increases. So if we just look at line one, which is liability insurance. We've been talking about it a lot today. The liability insurance shows an increase of $224,000 over the prior year budget. We are expecting significant premium increases in across all the lines of insurance but specifically in cyber and fiduciary. In addition to significant increases, also the 2022 budget, when we made it, did not fully reflect the renewal premiums that we received when they were actually incurred in 2022. So we were really hit hard by the cyber renewal last year, and that came in much higher. So that also is contributing to this variance. Line number two, investment consulting and reporting, up $110,000 in 2023. We are budgeting $75,000 for possible private market services. And you heard Ryan talk about that, and Bill, how we're beginning to go down that path of preparing for when we'll be ready to do private market services and what that could mean. So we budgeted $75,000 for that, along with $35,000 for the SB 322 services that we'll need. Line item number three, network security monitoring. This past year, our cybersecurity planning and remediation has been a top focus. We have worked and engaged a VCISO, which is a Chief Information Security Officer. They're assisting us in prioritizing projects. The 2023 budget includes a full year of the VCISO services. Again, the requirements that came out of our last year cyber insurance renewal were significant, and the expectations that are now being put on all companies if they just want to obtain cyber insurance at all are significant. John has done a great job this year in sorting through them all, trying to meet the requirements that are there, and then we're being proactive going into our next renewal. We've already asked, give us the new application. 3 years ago when we applied for cyber insurance, it was one page with five questions on it. Now it's, you know, 15 pages, three applications, lots of data. So the landscape has changed dramatically. Although John has always done a great job for us, just the requirements and sometimes the conflicting requirements of do this, but you can't do this because they also want you to do this. So that's going to continue to be a big focus for us during 2023. And as we look at item number four, miscellaneous professional services, you'll see an increase of $66,000. That was a strategic decision. Previously, we had budgeted for a full-time communication specialist. We have changed that plan and removed that position from a permanent position. It's now going to be a contract position. So we've really moved those dollars from a salary line down into this miscellaneous professional line. There's a few other items, but I want to go ahead and skip down to reductions and talk about some of the reductions. As we look at row eight, which are investment management fees, they're down $3 million or 24.6%. Again, the declines in fee schedules, most of those are related to private equity, the rate, and the decrease in the market value of the portfolio are driving the decrease in management fees. So we look at item nine, other portfolio operating expenses, down $337,000. We expect the settlement of the Lone Star case to result in lower expenses. Legal fees down $335,000 as we're budgeting expenses just based on the status of cases. And then item 11, down $226,000, reducing that headcount from 25 to 23 is reducing the expected expense. And part of that is partially offset by budgeted salary and benefit cost increases. So let's go ahead and go to the next page.
Brenda, can I ask one question just to clarify?
Yes.
Investment management fees, So if you have long-only managers, they charge a management fee. That's clearly part of this. Private equity firms where they have a management fee and a carry, is that in this so that the returns are really gross of manager fees and then we show all the expenses in the P&L, or how, is that?
So it's just the management fee. I don't think we've had any private equity have a carry in.
We've had a few carries, smaller amounts. That's harder to budget for. All the returns are net of all the fees. So, like, even though we budget for them,
okay,
it doesn't come out like
okay.
Everything
so,
we show.
So in a sense, when we show investment return and then all of our expenses, we are, in a sense, double counting, if you think about, like, a percent and a dollar amount of budgeted expense, we're double counting the investment management fees because the percent return is net of those expenses, and the budget also has those dollar-wise expenses. It's a percent and a dollar amount, but is that true?
Yeah, if you're
okay. Does everyone understand that? Well,
and we used to not budget for this, right? I mean,
not
the management fee.
So, like, this stuff that goes into the net investment performance are management fees and the other investment expenses. So we run all that through the investment portfolio.
Correct.
So our net return is net of those items.
Yeah.
But it's not net of
so
our overhead.
Returns a percent, budget dollars,
yeah.
And we're double counting it, that portion, whereas there's no other dollar expenses that we're double mm-hmm. counting in the return numbers.
Right. And
okay.
We used to not budget for those investment expenses, but the state law changed and requires that we do.
Yeah.
So that's
right. Okay.
And
which
position?
So why?
Pardon me?
Why is a practice for reporting that would we double count those? I mean, I understand the mechanics, but like, why would we do that? Can't we fix that?
We're not double counting. You know, when you present something in a percent, that is what it is, and you present something in dollars, it is what it is. But there's some overlap between the two. I think we'd be double counting it if we had a percent and percent number or a dollar and a dollar number, then you would want to exclude them. But we're presenting one set of data, which is the percent investment return, doing that net, and then separately we have our budget, and you're saying that the law requires us to budget for dollar amount investment management expenses. So I think that's probably the fairest and clearest presentation. It's important to note that overlap.
Yeah, all right, understood.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate that clarification.
So the head count from 25 to 23.
So we had a communications specialist position that I had budgeted for several years in a row, but I just don't have enough full-time work for that. So what we did was budget dollars in professional services to outsource some of that work.
Yeah.
And the other was an investment?
It was investment. Last year we had budgeted five
right.
investment positions. This year it's four. Any other questions? So I'm kind of flying through, so please feel free to ask questions. So now we're on page 33, and this is where we're comparing the 2023 budget to the 2022 projected actual. If we look at the first item, salary and benefits, showing that it's up $253,000, and that is driven by the 2022 projected actual because we had several vacant positions. The 2022 actual was lower than was expected. We hope to be fully staffed again in 2023. We've kind of talked about items 2 and 3, so let's hop down and look at information technology projects. So we budget for a certain number of projects every year. Shortly after the beginning of last year, we had the risk insurance renewal, and so we had to shift our focus to all of the cyber projects, cyber remediation. So some of the projects that we had budgeted for and planned for in 2022 have been deferred for us to focus on the cybersecurity and remediation, and our 2023 projects will be continuing to focus on cyber. If we come down, we look at one last item. Under reductions, other portfolio operating expenses down $1.4 million. And again, the settlement of the Lone Star case, we believe, will result in significantly lower expenses for this category. Are there any other questions about the budget variance detail line? Okay. Well, I'm going to finish this up by looking at some trending of the expenses here over the last few years. So we're looking at the 2016 actual on the far left-hand side, going all the way through to the 2023 budget. You can tell that there have been significant declines in investment and professional expenses. And let me just share, so you're maybe saying, well, there's four categories here. The first category is administrative, then we have investment, and that third category is investment management fees that are paid at the fund level. We wanted to go ahead and show how those have been progressing over the last few years that are not included in our budget. And then the final one is professional. So significant declines from the high periods of 2016 and 2017. As we look at the first group, which is administration, the 2023 proposed expenses have inched up over the prior years, primarily due to increased costs from insurance and the IT cyber costs that they are continuing to grow. We look at the next group, investment expenses. They're continuing to decline over time as some of the legacy assets investments are monetized and their related management fees and related expenses decline. We look at the third category, which are investment fees that are paid by the fund. They are also continuing to decline as the market value of the portfolio changes. And the last category is professional expenses, and they've been hovering around $1.2 million since 2018. So pretty steady there. Are there any questions about the 2023 proposed budget? Yes.
We need a motion.
Yeah, I was going to say we'll need a motion to authorize
the discussion.
Yes. Thank you. Sorry, going
okay,
back
up. Okay, so we want a motion to direct the staff to revise the proposed budget based upon the direction of the board, bring the revised proposal to the board for the November 10th, 2022 meeting, and authorize forwarding the 2023 proposed budget to the City of Dallas for comment and the posting of the proposed budget to the DPFB org for member review prior to the November meeting. Do we have a motion to do that?
So moved.
Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. So I'll continue on with the financial audit status. As Ryan mentioned, we did receive the Huff Energy financials, and we're very excited and happy to report that they arrived on September 14th. They were the last investment financial statements that we're waiting on to complete our audited financials. So I was able to complete our financials and send that information to the actuary. The actuary is working on the report. We believe that we'll have the actuary report by the end of October, and that will be presented to the board at the November board meeting. Then following that, we expect at the December board meeting that we will be presenting the DCFP audited financials, as well as the annual comprehensive financial report to the board in December. So we're getting close now. It's a relative term. Any questions about the status of the financial audit? to Kelly.
On page 38, is the contribution report. This is the same report that you saw last month and the other trustees have seen for many, many months. It's in line with what you have seen before. We're down on the October payroll, it was down 178 employees. Police was down, were down 232 employees. You saw a lot of those retirements and people leaving in the refunds in the police department in the last month. Fire was over their number by 54, so a net employee number down 178 from the hiring plan estimate. So this is the October report, and the information is delayed by 2 months, so it's August data. There were three pay periods that started in August, so this includes three pay periods. During this time frame, they continued with the trend of really being pretty close to the floor and the hiring plan. The actual contributions based on actual comp pay would have been $17.6 million for the three pay periods. The city had to contribute an extra $518,000 in August to meet the floor, so we're 97% of the floor for the month, 105% of the hiring plan. So nothing new to report here. Things are continuing on. But as you know, next year, when we get into these numbers, that floor column will that extra amount of money that we get for the floor, that will go away. Where we are on a contribution plan. Any questions on that report? Education and travel for the board is on page 41 and 42 of the materials. Here is the list of classes. Carol has gone ahead and added the 2023 text version and CEPR classes here. If you have any interest in attending any of these, reach out to Carol. She can get you the information and get you registered for those, and we will put you on for the next agenda to have board approval, unless there's anybody who wants to indicate interest today. Okay, and also just for the new members, if there are classes that you want to attend that you think are relevant to the pension system that aren't on this list, you can also reach out to Carol or I and let us know that, and we can look at getting those approved for you as well.
And Carol lets us know if we have any continuing education when we're due with that.
Right.
I think I got an email from the city of Dallas about something I had to do.
Yeah, that shouldn't – you should not have to do – that. I've got a message into the city.
Okay, anyone else get it?
I know Bill did.
Yeah. Well.
Okay, so ignore it right now?
For right now, yeah.
No. I may ignore it or I shall ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
You may ignore it.
Okay, what did they ask you to do?
All right.
I don't think I can order you to do anything.
Okay.
All right.
I think if you choose to do it, you can
count. I just learned the importance of those words.
Okay. Item 11, John, can you go there? I think it's 84 or 85. This is the committee, board committee appointments, and as we discussed under the investment policy statement, we'd like to add Nancy to the membership of the IAC. With the motion.
Move approval. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. I assume Nancy recused herself from that, right? Or is that just a minute? Is that the right way to, or does it matter?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you want to recuse yourself? Are you good?
Nancy, it's a badge of honor. I was actually off as a trustee for like a week or a day or some short period of time, so it's actually a badge of honor to be on, off, on. Okay, Kelly, do you want us to talk about the tape recording policy?
Yes, actually this item came out of a conversation, a brief conversation I had with Bill at the last meeting. He reminded me that we have continued to record these board meetings, which is actually not consistent with the board policy from 1986. So you may recall that at the beginning of the pandemic, Governor Abbott came out and allowed governmental entities, including us, to have virtual meetings, with the caveat that those meetings had to be made virtual and the recordings of those meetings had to be posted on our website. So we have been doing that. That emergency order has obviously since been lifted, and we no longer have to put the recordings on the website. We've continued to do that. So I need the board to tell me if you want me to continue to do that, and if so, rescind the policy, or if you don't want the recordings out there.
What's your recommendation?
My recommendation is to put them out there because I think it's helpful for the members. If they want to listen to something with the agenda, they can refer to it. I know staff has gone back and listened to various things at the board meetings, but it's really up to you all.
Does anyone feel strongly different to Kelly's recommendation?
No.
Okay, so
no.
You've adjusted the policy, or what is this?
I think we should just repeal the policy.
Repeal the policy. Okay, and then continue to post the audio recordings to the board meetings on the website. Okay? Do we need to have a motion to do that?
Yes.
Okay, do we have a motion?
I make a motion.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
And we'll try to remind you all at the beginning of each meeting that just a reminder these are being recorded because we tend to forget. Not that anybody says anything
right.
that I don't think is appropriate, just it's always good to know that that's what's going on there.
Some of us assume everything's recorded all the time.
It's still. But it is legal. Someone can, I mean, it's perfectly legal for someone to record the meeting if they're here in person or whatever, so that there's no prohibition against that.
Can we tell how many, other than staff, has gone back and listened to them? I mean, is there a...
John, I know we asked John to look into that, and it's
yeah,
not that
I can
simple.
See, so there's a minutes page, and that's where the recordings are, and see who goes to that page, and see who actually puts on the recording.
No, not the individual, but how many... We're getting like
yeah,
five.
I get the numbers for the page when they belong to either a PDF or a audio. I don't get that count. So it's inflated by the people that just look at the paper.
Okay.
So, yeah, we can't get that specifically, but you did. Did you say how many people are going to the page? 2,500, is that what?
Since the beginning of the year, yeah.
Yeah, 2,500. And I know the reporters listened to it because there was one month where we posted the prior month again, and he called me the next day and said, you have the wrong month up there.
No.
So the reporters listened to it. Should we skip to the executive director's report before we do legal?
Yes, please.
Okay. Your association newsletters are in Diligent and then your PDF for you. We've had 7 open records requests since the last board meeting. 6 of those were from reporters or people doing some studies. Type thing. One was from an actual member, so we're working on that one for the member. And then as an employee update, there's a new face behind you next to John, a long-awaited employee. That's Niam Nugin, and he joins us as a system analyst. So we waited a long time for John to have a little help, so just wanted to introduce you.
The Wynn? The Wynn? Is it Wynn?
Yes.
It's pronounced Wynn.
Wynn?
I said Nugent.
Oh.
Okay. It's Wynn.
Yeah, it's Wynn.
Sorry about that.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thrilled to have you on board.
And that's all I have.
And just one quick, on the last meeting I asked about the massaging of the budget that the city was trying to do. Any information, any update on that?
No, that actually has to do with open records requests from the employee. So the city had an account, this is my understanding, the city has an account, they called it Budget Stabilization Fund. They've taken that money and they've moved it to other priorities. That has no way impacts the amount of money that the city is giving to us.
Okay.
They're still making their contributions in whole. I anticipate they'll continue to make their contributions in whole. The $14 million in that account is not enough to, you know, solve our funding issues. So I think it was a budgeting issue on the city side. That's what I know.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to go into Closed session.